You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
Thank you so much.
Hello, everyone. You are free at any time to stretch and get snacks. Just a reminder, because we've been here about an hour. So just like, give me like a woo that shows you how long you want this sermon to go. Oh yeah, like a 4 minute situation. Bessie, I don't plan these. Okay, welcome to Esther and Daniel Read Intertextually. What are you talking about, Aiden? Why are you putting two books at once? Are you just trying to be esoteric? First of all, yes. But second of all, I can prove my point. In the Old Testament story, there's several key events. Most of them are exiles, and I only remember three of them, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians, because those ones go in alphabetical order. Daniel and Esther are set in the Babylonian and Persian exiles, respectively, stories of the Israelites under the regency of foreign kings and what they did with those times. These are really interesting stories to be read together, not just because they're two stories about my diaspora living under various oppressive circumstances, but also because they're the same genre, and so I think it's really interesting to put them together. So Daniel and Esther are both part of a genre called court tales, and they're the same genre that you see a lot of David's rise to power and also Joseph under Pharaoh. And some key like court tale genre, it's kind of like Bold and the Beautiful drama in a lot of way. The main character is always like hella attractive for no reason. The Hebrew very rarely describes physical appearance, so every time they're like, oh yeah, and Joseph, he was a good looking man, you're like, whoa. There's very clear good guys and bad guys. The plot is often a reversal of fortunes. Often, you know, the bad guy starts up here and then he goes, oh no, and then the good person starts down here and goes all the way up here. Often through a contest, a competition, or some other difficulty. So it's really common. Daniel 1 is like the who can get the buffest in 10 days with different diets, and it's all like that. There's heaps of exaggeration. There's always like, and then there were seven eunuchs and they went to the king, and then seven officials said this thing. It's like, whoa, your room is really big. Lots of exaggeration, lots of convenient like plot difficulties. Very common to be like, oh, well, you know, once the king makes a law, it cannot be revoked. Oh no, how are we going to fix the situation? When in reality, like historically, we don't think that was the case, but these kinds of, I forgot what the word is, conceits to create drama within like the course of the court plot. So we'll see that in both of these. And that's how they play with it. So yeah, exactly like a soap opera. Or like one of those animes where like they keep making the cut too long while the dramatic thing happens. What are those called? Just anime. Yeah. So in this series, we'll be doing a Daniel passage and an Esther passage that I think really speak to each other well. And then the third week in that block of three, we'll look at them together and the themes that they bring up. So in this block of three, we'll be looking at the story of Daniel's recruitment into the court palace and Esther's recruitment into the court palace, because I think you'll find they're really different stories, and I think they say something about perhaps the author's intentions of the time. So we're going to start with Daniel 1. I'm going to give you like the paraphrased Bible reading, so that's more interesting. Don't report me. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord let King Jehoiakim of Judah fall into his power, as well as a bunch of like the fancy gold that's in the temple. These he brought to the land of his own, and he placed them in the treasury of his gods. Then the king commanded his palace master to bring some of the noble Israelites, and he had a really long list about what they had to be. No physical defects, handsome, very wisingly wise, very intelligently intelligent, the Hebrew is like that. And they've got to be taught the tongue and the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the royal rations of food and wine. This is nice in that you now have food and wine, but now you're kind of like dependent on the king in this very deliberate daily rational kind of way. They had a three-year education period. Among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the tribe of Judah. The palace master, as is common when you move someone into your service or want to destine them for a different path, gave them other names in their language. Daniel he called Belshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. Those names are slightly more familiar, perhaps. But Daniel, interestingly, those last three names, they get referred to by their captivity names for the rest of the story, but Daniel mostly gets referred to as Daniel, which is sort of this interesting interplay of like, who's choosing to assimilate what? But Daniel, he resolved he would not defile himself with the royal rations of food and wine. Now, is this because there's like a power dynamic at play, or are these like unclean foods that he couldn't do as part of his ritual? We don't know, a part of his identity. So he asked the palace master to allow him not to defile himself. Now God allowed Daniel to receive favor and compassion from the palace master. The palace master said to Daniel, "Well, I am afraid of my lord the king. If he should see you in poorer condition than the other young men of your own age, you would endanger my head." Then Daniel said, "Well, you know, let's have a test. Let's have a contest. 10 days, give us seeds or vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then compare our appearance with the appearance of the young men on the royal rations." Now, 10 days isn't really long enough to compare diets unless there's like an acne problem happening. So I don't know what he was thinking. So the palace master agreed to this proposal, tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, it was observed they appeared better and fatter than all the young men who had been eating the royal rations. So the guard continued to withhold their royal rations and wine and gave them vegetables. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and skill in every aspect of literature and wisdom. Daniel also had insight into all visions and dreams. So, this text, when I was growing up in the church, was traditionally used to be like, it's really important to look really obviously Christian and be super distinct about it. And if you do, you'll look really cool and everyone would be like, "Oh, no worries, you can keep doing that." Did anyone else have a similar teaching of the story? And I've been thinking about this passage and its theme of arbitrary practices, perhaps, that mean something about your identity. So in this case, David wasn't a vegetarian because he thought eating animals was bad. Daniel, did I say David? Was part of his way of maintaining his distinct Jewishness. This is a really big question, especially for a lot of Christians who live overseas, and they say, what does it mean for us to look like we're Christians compared to others? And has always sort of had that kind of implication for me. But when I was thinking about this passage, I was thinking about other symbols we use to indicate our cultural groups. One time I wore a flanny tucked into my green corduroy jeans and my housemate said, "That's the most non-binary fit I've ever seen in my entire life." And I felt really embarrassed and never wore it again. And I've also been in churches where there's a really powerful implicit rule about how you dress. I went to one where all of like, it was like half like women who had long hair in their natural colors and half men with short hair. And I was like, I have to get out of here. And so what I want to question about Daniel's story is it fair to talk about this as an example of religious distinction without also recognizing that this is maybe also about Daniel's authentic expression of who he was? I don't want to leave this story with the question of like, oh, what can we do to make sure that we look like we're God's people when other people see us? But think about, is this a story that rewards, being authentic isn't quite right. But I wonder if we have our own practices that signal our faithfulness to what we believe in and our faithfulness to God. Are those valuable, whether or not those are everyone's practices? What are those for us? Where can we create space for them to shine? So that's my thoughts. Any questions or response thoughts? Yeah.
I didn't grow up hearing that reading of Daniel's doing this and this is why we have to be seen as Christians. So I did hear other verses that were about being seen as Christian, but not this one specifically. It feels like a bit of a weird reading to me for then people to read that into it, because it was something that he very specifically couldn't be seen doing for the king. It was more of a personal thing, at least that's how I see it.
Like refusing to look like, to evoke, to participate almost in like a morally compromised situation. Is that what you mean?
He has a personal belief, a personal thing, that he's not trying to show it to the king that look at this, I'm doing this. It's, yeah, holding firm to himself, not about a performative thing.
Anybody else?
I mean, I just had this thought when you raised before that there's this weird kind of sentiment that the king is making them dependent on him for daily food. And having just come off Exodus, it's kind of a contrast to the daily manna and quail that God gave them. And I wonder if that's like, obviously Daniel still has to get the vegetables from the gods, but is there a point where he's distancing himself from being reliant on the king in the way that Israelites were reliant on God?
I think there definitely could be a parallel there. I love that. I think the other big King's Table motif we have is when David invites the last descendant of Saul to eat at his table. And I think that was like a very clear patronage example. So I reckon there is that kind of theme of like, is eating from the king's table like putting your allegiance and your livelihood in the king?
I think just going off what Carl also kind of started with is that sense of like empire and kingdom. And so it's, once again, it's not to show like to be performative, but like that sense of going, the empire has this system and this dependence and this structure, and like stepping out of that. To then step into like, okay, how can I lean into living kingdom life and not kind of living empire life, and just kind of more about it being kind of that distinction. rather than trying to, you know, show off your religion to somebody else, but more of a sense of, yeah, which system am I stepping in and leaning into at which time?
Does anyone have any, like, concrete applications of that idea, maybe?
It's quite a question, actually, because if you read the second book, Exodus, and if you read if you read Leviticus and Deuteronomy, there are like a set of rules for the Israelites to look like, to look different from the Egyptians, and at the same time different from the Canaanites. So it's actually a question, because I'm not sure, isn't it related to this, you know, history of trying to be set apart and holy, different from these nations? Like, so they had this, like, I don't know, 313 laws, rules, something like that. I'm not sure the exact number, but like, you have to follow these rules, so you have to be different from the Egyptians, from Egypt, the land that you were, you know, you were set free from these people, and you're going towards to this new land, and they have their own way of living, and we have to make sure that we are different from them as well. And then I was just thinking, maybe this is something that Daniel and his friends grew up with. Like, we have to be different somehow. We have to, you know, be clearly different whenever people look at us, and the way that we behave, the way that we live life. So I think it might be related to that. Is it?
I think that is a really, I think that probably is the biggest theme in Daniel, is like ethno-religious distinction. And I think this, just as a type story for many things that happens in Daniel, it really does seem to encourage that idea of distinctness and faithfulness in choosing to be different from those around you despite that pressure. And I think that's a theme that we can all relate to. It's a weaponized theme as well, I think, but I think that is a really important encouragement, especially for people who are, well, forcibly moved cultures, like in Daniel, or in other similar circumstances. Yeah.
Yes, super interesting. I grew up with your original reading, the way that, yeah, certainly, very much so. So hearing your take, it was just like, oh, that's refreshing. Because I think the pressure to be different and be distinct was really strong. And I think for me, a story like this feels a little bit a little bit distant, because I don't live under a legal setting where certain foods are kosher. Like that's just not my tradition. But I'm thinking this week of things like where, particularly out of like US evangelicalism, where empathy has become a bad thing. Like, it's a sinful thing to have empathy. I'm just shocked that that is what's happening. And I wonder, for me, as I'm thinking this through, what makes me different? I want to have empathy. And for me, that flows out of my faith. So I'm trying to think of things that, like, you know, make me look maybe a little bit different to the world, but I'm not doing it because I want to look different to the world. I'm just doing it because naturally, by being a Christian, some things shift. And I don't want to do it out of, you know, showiness. I want to do it with integrity. But I don't know. I'm just trying to think of, as you said, concrete examples. But I feel like maybe for me that is one of those things, like that empathy and care and justice that flows out.
Radical empathy is a form of cultural distinction. I love that. That's great. Well, that's a great place to leave it, I think. Yeah, I guess if you think that radical empathy is part of a way that you're faithful to God and God's presence in your life, I think let's take this story as an encouragement to continue to be distinct in that way, not so that people in power see and are impressed, but because we believe in it. Okay, would you like to pray about it? Okay. Our Mother in Heaven, please give us radical empathy. Help us to see your face, our face, and the face of a lover in the faces of those we meet. Let us blend together in our love for one another. Let us work out how to cross divides of real distinction to call injustice injustice and cruelty cruelty, while yet having radical empathy and love for the humanity in each other. Amen.